Support for this program is provided by Chevron, the human energy company.
Hey, this is Politico Energy. I'm your host, Alex Guillen. In the next few weeks, I'm expecting the Supreme Court to rule in a case that could really weaken the rulemaking power of government agencies and presidents, regardless of party. And to understand how big of a deal this truly is, I actually have to take you back to the Supreme Court in 1984.
Gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Chevron against Natural Resources Council.
There's this famous legal precedent called Chevron deference, which is named after this case between the oil giant Chevron and the Reagan administration against an environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council. Essentially, the Supreme Court gave agencies this powerful shield to defend their rulemakings on the environment and virtually every other policy area. But for more than a decade now, conservative legal scholars have increasingly turned against it. And by the end of June, the court is poised to narrow or even overturn the doctrine. So today, I wanted to talk about the importance of Chevron deference with someone who was there from the beginning.
Mr. Doniger,
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. As Mr. Justice Stevens has said,
David Doniger was a young lawyer back in 1984 who represented the NRDC during this famous case. These days, he's still at the NRDC and is a prominent environmental lawyer. Even though Doniger lost that case, the outcome was actually beneficial for many environmental regulations. And he's warning that a ruling now to weaken Chevron deference could be dangerous. Here's my extended interview with David Doniger. It's Monday, June 17th. David Doniger, thank you for chatting with me for the Politico Energy podcast.
Happy to be here.
So when you walked into the Supreme Court that morning in 1984 to argue this case, were you expecting it to become one of the most cited cases in history?
No, everything about this case was a surprise. It was a run-of-the-mill administrative law case challenging the first deregulatory moves by the Reagan EPA in the clean air space. And we had won in the lower court. I was surprised when the government sought to take the case up. I've since learned from notes of Sandra Day O'Connor and Harry Blackmun that they almost didn't take the case and that when it was argued, we almost won. It was a very close vote initially.
So we're here to talk about Chevron deference, which is named after the 1984 case you argued for the NRDC. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on that specific case and the details of that, but basically you were disagreeing over how to interpret part of the Clean Air Act with the Reagan administration. Tell us about how the Supreme Court ruled and what the goal of that ruling was.
The case was about the meaning of the term stationary source. It's a term that appears all over the Clean Air Act because the Clean Air Act regulates stationary sources and mobile sources. 1977 Clean Air Act amendments had added stronger provisions for the review of new industrial projects going into the most polluted areas. The goal of the Reagan administration in changing the definition of the source was to evade all those requirements. So we went to the Court of Appeals and argued that this was contrary to the plain language of the law and contrary to the structure and purposes, and we won a kind of an odd decision from the D.C. Circuit. The government took the case up to the Supreme Court. Actually, the Justice Department's Solicitor General's office, they told me they didn't recommend taking it up, but it was pretty much ordered by Boyden Gray, who was working for Vice President Bush at the time. In the oral argument, we made the same pitch. The law is clear. The statute is clear. The government's position was, we think it should be different. And I remember looking over the shoulder of the government's attorney, Paul Bator, straight at Sandra Day O'Connor. And when he said that, she pursed her face up in a very dissatisfied way. Anyway, we thought we had won. When the opinion came out, it became obvious that Justice Stevens, who wrote it, had a bigger objective. He was unhappy, they all were unhappy, that the D.C. Circuit had these decisions which turned not on what the law said, but on the policy preferences of the judges on the panel, so it seemed. And the gist of the Chevron decision is lower courts stopped doing that. The interpretation of statutes, first, if they're clear, you have to rule that they're clear and enforce them. That's the proper job of the courts. But if they are ambiguous, that's a judgment by the Congress, elected by the people, that the agency should have a role in interpreting that flexible term. I didn't disagree with that as legal doctrine. I thought that was restating what the rules were before. So we thought they made a mistake in the application of the test, but that the test was a sound approach. Then turned out to be a very widely cited case. I think there's some 12 or 15,000 lower court decisions that turn on Chevron, and we were off.
So this became, I know it's named after a case that involved environmental law, but it did eventually start being applied to practically every policy area, technology, healthcare, immigration, veterans benefits, mm-hmm. It's everything. And then it was, for a while, it was a pretty popular doctrine across the spectrum.
Right, because it's neutral. The original decision upheld a deregulatory decision. Subsequent decisions upheld more assertive interpretations of statutes and basically gave space for the administration, responsive to the president, to carry out a policy agenda within limits.
But that's been changing in recent years, maybe the last 15 years. What's going on? Why have conservative legal thinkers, so many of them, turned against Chevron deference?
Well, I think the real motivations are the interests of the right-wing billionaires and big industry, mainly very conservative people, they want the government off their lawn. They do not want to be regulated. And they see more danger from their own selfish perspective in a doctrine that lets democratic administrations interpret laws assertively. They see more danger in that than anything else. But that's not the way they explain it. They hired a bunch of conservative lawyers to come up with more plausible sounding legal rationales, like this is a question of law and judges are supposed to have the final word on questions of law. I think they're questions of policy. That's what most law is. Most law sets policy.
You know, it sounded at arguments like there are definitely enough votes among the court's conservative majority to do something to Chevron deference, narrow it significantly, perhaps, if not overturn it outright. So I just wanted to probe, what are the stakes here if that happens?
Yeah, well, broadly speaking, I would agree that if Congress hasn't written a statute that tells an agency to do something, the agency just can't decide to do it. So silence, absolute silence, is not authority. But it's really about the extent of respect for agency views that's going to be given in these other situations. I can foresee a range of possible outcomes. One would be simply that, and it would sort of echo what Justice Kennedy said in his last opinion just before he retired. He said he was in favor of reviewing the Chevron doctrine because agencies were, he thought, being too quick to jump from the statutory text to ambiguity and too quick to say, there's no clear meaning here, so let's defer to the agencies. So one outcome could be struggle more with the statutory language to figure out whether it has a clear meaning. The more radical outcomes are sort of to reverse what was the central message of Chevron from Justice Stevens, which is judges, don't insert your own policy views over those of the agencies. Policy is for the political branches. You have a more humble and circumscribed role. The right-wing movement to kill Chevron is arguing that judges should be very assertive, that they're the ones who should decide what the statute is. They should give no particular respect to what interpretations they've come up with. No deference to the agency's expertise in running a program. You, the judges, are the ones who should decide these things because we've classified them as questions of law and not policy. And that would be very disruptive. It would turn lower court judges loose to do what the D.C. Circuit judges were doing back in the 70s, which is letting their own policy views, not letting them, forcing their own policy views on the agencies. And you have even more than you already do, you'll have companies or even environmental groups shopping for the best forum, and you'll have a lot of inconsistent judgments. And actually, the Supreme Court would have more work to do. They would have more disagreements among the lower courts to resolve. In the meantime, everyone, from environmentalists to companies, would be less certain about what the rules of the road are in their particular area, because everything would be more controversial and subject to the whims of individual judges.
And this is something I've heard from pro-Chevron folks as this has been playing out, is that if Chevron is overturned or something and judges are more free to strike down rules, that will apply to, you know, Biden administration rules, but a future Republican president could face a left-leaning judge who may strike down his own rules. So there's arguments that it could backfire in that sense.
Yes. The Chevron doctrine basically gives administrations of either stripe more leeway, and that makes the system actually more predictable. Now, there's concern that's voiced from the right. What happens when you go from a right-leaning administration to a left-leaning administration? You get these swings in policy. I would say the same thing in reverse. What happens when you go from a liberal administration to a hyper-conservative one? What I'm worried about, most worried about, is that it's always been true since the founding, but especially in the modern era, the world throws complicated problems at our society, at our government, with, you know, more and more huge issues, very complicated. Congress doesn't have the bandwidth to deal with any one subject more than maybe once every 10 years. Congress doesn't have the expertise to figure out COVID or clean air issues down to the level that you really have to. They don't have the foresight to imagine, well, what's the next problem? So they write statutes which are intended not just to deal with the pollutants that are right in front of them at the time they write the statute, but to set up a kind of a regime for dealing with new things, new problems, new pollutants that come along. If the conservative attack, it's broader than just taking down Chevron, but if the conservative attack were to succeed, you would end up with Congress not being able to enlist the agencies to do this kind of work. And it would all be on the shoulders of Congress to do it itself. And they can't. So the hidden agenda, or not very hidden agenda, on the right, is to enfeeble modern government. One thing I've seen in recent writings by Gorsuch really disturbs me. He said in one of his COVID concurrences and in the West Virginia concurrence that regulation should be hard because what regulation does is limit liberty. Well, whose liberty? What disturbs me about Gorsuch's writings is he seems to recognize only the liberty interests of the powerful and not the liberty interests of the powerless.
You mentioned West Virginia a minute ago. That's referring to the 2022 case from the Supreme Court where they limited EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases from power plants. They said you can't rely on generation shifting, which was what the Obama administration had tried to do. That's also the case where they formally named the what's called the major questions doctrine,
yeah,
which is a much more stringent sort of standard that's much harder for agencies to meet. And it says if there's a regulation of significant economic or political impact, then Congress needs to have explicitly authorized it.
Well, there's something more than that. It's not enough that it's a big regulation. Courts have to find that the agency is stretching its authority in some new direction, doing something different from what it did before, something novel, something expansive. That's what triggers the, as Justice Kagan put it, the eyebrow raise. That's what gets your surprise level up. You know, the EPA has absolutely clear authority to regulate vehicle emissions. Doing that is expensive. Just because it's expensive, because that's like the biggest industry in the country, just because it's expensive doesn't make it a major question if EPA is doing it in the way that it has done it before.
Although we are seeing opponents of the Biden administration's vehicle tailpipe emissions rules argue that they are, at this point, violating major questions because the rules are starting to lead to really significant adoption of electric vehicles, which is relatively new.
They are going to lose those cases. We're going to win. EPA is going to win those cases.
And okay.
We're on EPA's side. That's my prediction. Because what EPA is doing is, what the court said in West Virginia is, EPA, this is again about power plants, you don't have the authority to regulate the power plants through this generation shifting idea, which is novel, and they didn't understand it and mischaracterized it, actually. But it was novel. But you do have the authority to regulate in the traditional manner of technology-based standards, I'm paraphrasing, that cause power plants to operate more cleanly. What came out of West Virginia is a pretty strong statement by the Supreme Court that EPA continues to have the authority to operate in the traditional manner, to regulate in the traditional manner, and set technology-based standards for the power plants, which EPA has now done. Those become more traditional factual questions on which the courts, including the Supreme Court, agree that the agencies deserve deference for factual, scientific, technical, economic fact-finding that's in their wheelhouse.
But we could see that change now with the Supreme Court expected to narrow or overturn Chevron deference.
Well, what happens, so the major questions doctrine is an exception from Chevron. But even as they framed that exception, it didn't apply where the agency was doing its traditional thing. When you're within your authority, you get deference on your fact-finding on subjects that experts are needed for, like science, technology, and economics. I don't think we're going to see a change come out.
Right. Just where do you see things going in the future now? If the courts are essentially giving themselves more power to overturn regulations, how is that going to play out in especially environmental areas and especially climate change? Because Congress has not passed a lot of laws that are very explicit about EPA regulating greenhouse gases. They're often using statutes that have been updated in over 30 years.
Yeah. The West Virginia case, yes, it announced a big new doctrine. But as I said, it also affirmed that the agency had the authority to regulate greenhouse gases as long as you stuck to your traditional tried and true approaches. It's possible that the current power plant and vehicle regulations will pass muster because they don't break any new legal ground. And the court's not interested in mucking around in thousands of pages of factual and scientific and technical issues. They still defer to the agencies on those. So even if there's some narrowing of Chevron, I think the agencies are going to continue to have the authority to regulate and to regulate in the climate area. They're going to have to be very thorough and explicit in explaining why what they're doing is being done in the traditional way that they regulated other pollutants in the past. They're not breaking any new systematic ground, so to speak, about how you regulate.
Well, some bold predictions there about Chevron deference in its future, but if anyone is qualified to make them, it's you. David Doniger, thank you for chatting with me for the Politico Energy Podcast.
Thanks. I'd like to say, you can fit this in if you want, that my career would be bookended by the birth and death of the Chevron doctrine, and I'll be on the losing side both times.
For more news on energy and the environment, subscribe to our free newsletter at politico.com/power-switch. And subscribe to Politico Pro to read our morning energy newsletter. Some of the music in today's show was composed by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. And that's our show. I'm Alex Guillen, and we'll see you back tomorrow.
Support for this program is provided by Chevron. Chevron is taking action to keep methane in the pipe. Their 2028 upstream methane intensity target is set to be 53% below the 2016 baseline. And they're committed to evolving facility designs and operating practices. That's energy in progress. Learn more at chevron.com/methane.